Hello and welcome to the podcast called Against the Law, where we aim to bust ancient myths and learn a fact or two about history in the process. What's in a name? Well, quite a lot actually. For today's episode we have some very interesting things to learn about names. Let me introduce everyone. We're joined as always by Xenia, who is the real McCoy when it comes to ancient Rome. We're also joined by Meg, a jack of all trades, who will share her knowledge about ancient Greece. Reassuringly, we have Barney here, a real smart aleck who'll be telling us all about names in the ancient Near East. And we're also joined by one of our favourite guests, Caroline Lawrence. She's the author of the Roman Mysteries series and has joined us before. She also introduced us to the apotropaic alarm. And for newer listeners, if something is apotropaic, it has the power to ward off evil. A sort of lucky charm, if you will, just like Caroline. Lastly, I'm Flo, and I don't know jack about the ancient world, but I'm really excited to be joining the team to learn all about ancient names. So we're here today to talk about names, which I'm very excited about. I love a little bit of etymology. And in the West, we are quite used to having a first name and a surname. And sometimes as a little treat, we'll pop in a middle name as well. And I, doing some research for this episode, discovered that my surname is actually Latin in origin, and it means blessed, which is a really nice thing to hear. So I'm kind of wondering, now I've got this bias, what names were like in Roman times?
In Roman times, you had a praenomen, a nomen and a cognomen. Praenomen means the first name, nomen means the name. The middle one is the most important. It tells you what clan or family you're from. The praenomen, there were only about 20 first names that men could have. Women didn't get a praenomen at all. That's how important they were. And then the cognomen is like your last name or a nickname. And just for a quick example, in my books, The Roman Mysteries, I have a character called Flavia Gemina, or you might want to say Flavia Gemina, but I'm going to say Flavia Gemina. And her father is Marcus Flavius Geminus. So he's got the three names. Marcus, a very common praenomen. Flavius, the gens, the race, the tribe, and then Geminus means a twin. But Flavia gets a feminized version of his second and third name, so she's Flavia Gemina.
That's really interesting, because when I think of Romans, I think of two names, like Julius Caesar or Marcus Aurelius.
Julius Caesar was Gaius Julius Caesar.
Oh, okay.
So he did have the full three names.
Gaius is a different vibe for him, isn't it? If we all knew him as Gaius Caesar.
Yeah, it's where we get the word guy. Hey, guy.
Hey, guy. He was just some guy.
And Marcus Aurelius is interesting because that's his first, and his first name is Marcus. That's his praenomen. And then Aurelius is his clan, his gens, his nomen. But he freed a bunch of Romans. And so many, many Romans took on the name. Tons of Romans are called Marcus Aurelius, and then they get their nickname at the end. It's like they're all taking his name, because you would take the name of your owner or your patron if you were a slave and you became freed. So, for example, in Flavia's family, there's Caudex, which means blockhead. I love the way the names mean something. And Caudex, he becomes Flavius Caudex when he's set free, whereas before, slaves just usually have one name.
I love the concept that there's lots of people wandering around with the same name. Imagine if we did that now, the DVLA would be a nightmare.
It's like Marcus Aurelius is like the John Smith of the ancient world.
And that's why the nickname, the cognomen, was so important. And I love nicknames are so fun because, again, every name means something. So, for example, one of my favorites is Cicero, or maybe you could say Cicero, and that actually means chickpea. They think his nose had a little cleft in it like a chickpea.
I shall think of him every time I have hummus now.
I know. And every time you think of Cicero, you can't take him seriously when you think of his little, having a little kind of bulbous tip of his nose like a chickpea. And then Naso means nose. That's a nice one. Brutus means dull or stupid, which I love. Lupus was a common name, which means wolf. That's quite cool. Caligula means little baby boot. So it's a diminutive of Caliga, because when he was a little baby, they dressed him up like a little mini soldier. So
if I called up Caligula, would it be a booty call?
Very good, very good.
Thank you.
Moving quickly along, one of my favorites is Flaccus or Floppy. And Floppy becomes the main romantic lead in my Roman mysteries. And he, of course, was a real person, Gaius Valerius Flaccus, who was a poet of the Silver Age. That's the late 1st century AD, so...
Naso, is that Ovid's name? Is that right?
Mm.
Yes, he's got a nose. He's got a nose.
Publius Ovidius Naso. Or sometimes, wouldn't it have been like one of his ancestors might have had a nose and then they keep adopting the same cognomen? Or is that unique for each person?
Well, a cognomen you usually give either at birth or they can get something called a cognomen virtute, a virtue.
Oh.
So if you achieve something, like Africanus gets his cognomen when he conquers Africa and things like that. But I guess poor little babies aren't born with a big nose. Oh, I'm calling that one Nazo.
But imagine that, being having such a big nose that your like great-great-grandchildren are still called Nose.
One of my best friends, a Greek woman, was called Grisopoulou, was her surname, which means gray hair. And although she'd had it for many, you know, many generations, she went prematurely gray. So it's a real genetic thing in her family. And often I think there are genetic predispositions in families.
That's called nominative determinism, isn't it? When you have a name that dictates what you end up doing.
I actually think I have a bit of nominative determinism to share about myself.
Oh, go on.
So on the topic of surnames, my surname is Dyson, like the vacuum cleaner. And I don't make vacuum cleaners, so.
I was going to say.
Failed on the first hurdle there. But both my first name and my surname are ultimately from Greek names. And I have just completed my PhD on ancient Greek literature. So I feel like there's something going on there. But specifically my surname, Dyson, you'd think like, yeah, vacuum cleaner is quite like a kind of, you'd think it was a patronymic, right? Patronymic is where your name is from your father's name, so the son of Di. But Dyson is in fact a matronymic name, which is where you get it from your mother. And there was this guy in like someone in my extended family has traced it all the way back. There's some guy in like the 14th century who called himself the son of Dionysia, which was a woman who was in turn named after Dionysus, which I think is pretty cool given that I study like ancient Greek literature.
That is so cool. Mm. And I would like to award you a laurel wreath for completing your PhD.
Oh, thank you, Karen.
And by the way, the word laurel wreath in Latin is Laurentina, which is where my surname comes from.
A fantastic segue. Xenia, your name's presumably Greek origins.
Ah.
Ah.
So there's a Greek version and there's a Russian version.
Oh.
It's a very boring story because we don't actually know where my name comes from. I was named after my Nana, Xenia, and then my parents wanted to continue that name because it was so unusual. But they actually didn't know Greek. They didn't know anything about the Greek xenia, hospitality, guest friendship. Mm. So when I started studying Latin and ancient Greek at school, suddenly I discovered that my name was really closely connected to what I loved to study. So cool. I just had to write my undergraduate dissertation on xenia.
Xenia on xenia. I love
indeed.
That. The practice of naming someone after a grandparent was very common in Greece, and still is actually in ancient Greece and in modern Greece. The firstborn son would be named after like the paternal grandfather, then the second son after the maternal grandfather. So you're also continuing that tradition.
Oh, lovely. Oh, I have a question for you, Meg. You know, this actually relates to the meaning of my name, Xenia. So didn't they used to name their children after like the family sort of guest friendships that they had across cultures or across city states? So like, I think Alcibiades was named after his like Spartan Xenos.
Oh, that's so cool. I didn't know that. Yeah, that could definitely be true. There's a lot of, I was going to say earlier when you're talking about slaves, there's a lot of like place names, especially for slaves in ancient Greece. Like you get named after a place, which might be where you'd originally come from or where your like owner was from or whatever.
Similar with Roman slave names. So Caroline already said that they had tended to just have the one name, but sometimes they would be renamed when they became a slave and just kind of, so there were some quite common slave names like Felix, you see that quite a lot. Phoebe is quite a common female slave name.
I should probably say with the Greeks, slaves have one name, but so does literally everybody else. the Greeks have none of this praenomen, cognomen, excessive nonsense. There's pretty much just one name for everybody. And then you would also be identified by the name of your father and where you were from. So Alcibiades would be like Alcibiades, son of Cleinias. I did look this up earlier. Cleinias, I'm gonna stick with that.
I should know. I just wrote a book about him. I think that segues to Barnabas, Barney. So what? I want to know what his name means. I think I know what it means. But
hello. Well, unfortunately, my name is actually short for Barnacle. Barney is my full name, actually. Although, obviously, the name Barney does derive from Barnabas or Barnaby, which is of Hebrew origin and means son of the prophet.
Actually, can I be pedantic? It's Aramaic, because Bar is son in Aramaic and Ben is son in Hebrew.
Ooh.
So it's both Semitic languages, but yes.
Okay.
It's a great Semitic Mesopotamian name.
Well, exactly. And, you know, I have had the privilege of learning two Semitic languages in my time, and I happen to have a Semitic name. So, yeah. What I quite like about talking about like the origins of our names and stuff is that thinking about when a lot of people in the modern world, or at least the Western world, English-speaking world, hear names, they don't necessarily understand what the names mean, literally, right? But I think Akkadian names, definitely, in ancient Mesopotamia, were all derived from common speech, so they were probably well understood generally.
Yeah, pretty much the same in Greece. Like you can either have a simple name, which would be like, you know, basically an adjective. And some of them are quite funny, like, you know, Aeschylus, the playwright, his name comes from Aeschros, which means ugly. Like they were quite savage in their naming sometimes. But everyone would know what that meant. That was, you know, quite a common name. Or you could have like a compound name where your name's made up of two different Greek words. So like probably the coolest example is Patroclus from the Iliad. Pater is father, as it is in Latin, and like patriarchy, all those words. And Kleos is fame or glory. And if you switch that round, you get Cleopatra. So her name is exactly the same as Patroclus' name, but with the two elements in the other direction.
Wow. I've just had a revelation. Maybe some of the insulting names, like ugly and chickpea, are apotropaic. To keep away evil, because if that's the way they would offer, you'd denigrate your baby. Oh, my baby's ugly. He's not very good looking. Because you don't want, because if your baby's beautiful, they're particularly susceptible to the evil eye.
When I name my child, I think I might call it something like Fat Ugly Spud or Terrible Screamer or Gavin.
Caroline, is that your name? Is that Latin?
They always give it as the feminine of Charles.
Yeah, because it's from the Carolingian Empire, isn't it?
Yeah, yeah. And then Charles means masculine. So what does the feminine of Charles mean? Does that mean I'm quite butch, or does it mean I'm extremely female? I don't know. I have no idea what it means.
There's a lot of pairs of names, like Joan for John, names that have a sort of female version of an existing male name. And I find that quite interesting.
Well, Roberta, say, for example, would be the version of Flavia for Flavius, wouldn't it? Add an A on. Or Nigella. Yeah.
I love that one.
Davina, as in Davina McCall.
All absolute icons.
Amazing hair. All women. Yeah. So as we're thinking about the female versions of men's names, so as a woman, you've got no option for praenomen in the Roman world. Is there anything interesting in the world of female names in the ancient world?
Well, one interesting and insulting thing is that for Roman women, because they all had the same version of their father's name, they would give them the nickname, the cognomen, first, second, third, fourth, fifth, and sixth, and just count them off like that.
So if you've got if you have loads of daughters that you basically, and it's dinner time, or you want one of them, and you go Flavia, they all go what? And you go, okay, sorry, the third one. Sorry, no, the fourth one.
Flavia Quinta, you know, the fifth one or something like that. Yeah. And then I think that you could have Maiora and Minora, so bigger and smaller, the first older and the younger. And then, of course, you can always add the diminutive. So you can have Flavilla. You can add an illa on it to make it a little Flavia.
Imagine being the middle child of three girls all named the same thing, and you've got an older sister and a younger sister, one's little and one's big, and you're just plain old Flavia.
Mediocre.
Flavorless.
I think that's where we get like Drusilla. It should be, it's the female of Drusus, but it's got the illa on it. So Drusilla is little Drusus, little female Drusus.
That makes sense, yeah.
In all fairness, they did also, men got the cognomen of first, second, secundus, tertius, quartus, quintus, etc.
Like famously Gaius Plinius Secundus.
Yes, thank you.
I've got a women's names thing.
Oh, women's names.
The thing I was talking about with the joining the names together, that does sometimes mean you get like women's names that didn't sort of technically make sense. So there are some, you get some jokes about it. Like, so Callistratos is a male name, like having a good army, beautiful army. But then you get like Callistrater would be the female version. And everyone would be like, haha, she's a woman, she can't have an army. And that was a sort of, that would be a funny joke for the Greeks. But you also get, and I think this is fun because we still do this, you get women's names just sort of, which are just virtues, like beautiful or, you know, excellent, which we still do. I feel like you get those kind of English names like Charity.
What you said about having a joke name that couldn't possibly apply to them, because a woman with an army, teehee. It made me think immediately of Mary Beard. I'm not saying that women can't grow beards. They absolutely can. It's just maybe more unusual. And we still have surnames that mean things like Redbeard or, you know, Yeoman.
It's sort of the opposite of nominative determinism. It's like, you didn't do that.
Yeah, exactly. They're names that we can't really apply to ourselves.
Such a good point, yeah.
So we've heard a little bit about ancient Greek names, and we've heard a little bit about ancient Roman names. Barney, what were names like in the ancient Near East?
Well, names in the ancient Near East, specifically Akkadian names, as I mentioned earlier, were derived from speech. I suppose as all names are, but well understood as such as well. And there's a lot of different categories, but my favourite type of name in the ancient Near East is definitely the sentence-based name. And there's quite a lot of these. So that meaning that, you know, it's a properly grammatically formed sentence instead of just, you know, a place or a feature or a god or something like that. For example, the king Ashurbanipal means the god Ashur has provided a son. Sounds like a good name to give a child, right? We've had the child, and so you say, great, our God has given this to us. But that's his whole name. His whole name is a sentence, which is nice. And it's Ashurbani Apli, rather than Ashurbanipal in Akkadian itself.
Barney?
Yeah, I know.
Wow.
Here we go again, yeah. If you do Barney with a long Y at the end, instead of just like Barney, it means my creator.
Oh.
Which I quite like.
Yeah.
But
that's,
yeah, there's
give you an ego.
Yeah, exactly. But there's, you know, there's ungrammatical names as well, just like features that people might have. So like Banitu is a name which means beautiful. Nur Sin, light of Sin, the god, the moon god actually. So that's quite a nice name. And we still see Nur as an element in Arabic names today, like Nur ad-Din, which means light of religion.
Isn't that similar to ancient Egyptian names? Like, for example, Tutankhamun is Tutankhamun, where Amun is the name of a god, and if a different god is in favour, his name would be changed. Or have I made that up?
No, that's correct. And I think we've talked about this recently on the podcast, actually, that Tutankhamun's name changed during his life from Tutankhaten to Tutankhamun when the sort of main god of his dynasty changed.
Be like me being called Florence Tony Blair surname and then later on being called Florence David Cameron surname.
If you consider our prime ministers to be your deity, then sure.
Yeah. Well, you know, like just leaders, just like leading figures. Mm-hmm. We don't change our deities very often. So I just went off leaders for the time being.
I guess it might be more like the Queen. You know, yeah. we're going to change like God Save the Queen to God Save the King, presumably, yeah, at some point.
Yeah, you could go with the, you know, pop charts. You could be like Meg BTS Dyson, Meg Lizzo Dyson.
Yeah, that's actually my Twitter name, so.
Just thinking of Egyptian and stuff, that names are very powerful, aren't they? And in Egyptian hieroglyphics, they're outlined with the cartouche, with the kind of the oval to make them stand out so that you can see that's the name. And that was one clue I think they got to deciphering the hieroglyphics with the Rosetta Stone.
The cartouche is just for royal names.
Oh.
But it does, I mean, that is exactly how they deciphered the Rosetta Stone, right? It was Cleopatra that was a useful name because obviously that was easy to read repeatedly throughout the text. It wasn't the famous Cleopatra, but another Cleopatra, but that was a helpful one. And then also Ptolemy, I think.
It's really cool.
But what Caroline was saying there about power and Egyptian names is a very good point. And names were really, really important to them. You know, naming things is the way that the creator god creates them, for example. And, you know, kings and individuals throughout Egyptian history constantly express wishes that their names will be remembered and remain in people's mouths and be permanent in that way so that they would continue to exist. And you can see the paranoia over knowledge and sort of possession of people's names in a type of curse called an execration, where people would write somebody's name on a piece of pottery, maybe with a curse, and then break it.
Oh, that's like Damnatio Memoriae in Rome, where you want to erase someone's name from and smash their images, yeah.
Or like ostracism in Greek. And we've discussed this before, but ostracism, the word comes from ostraca, which is like, or an ostracon, is a shard of pottery. And you'd write someone's name on their ostracon. And then if someone gets enough votes, they would be exiled or ostracized from the city. And that's actually, ostraca are some good evidence for the kind of names that people actually had and how they were addressed. Because lots of Greeks had sort of nicknamed or shortened names as well. So it's like different on the ostracon to how it would be in sort of high literature, which is really interesting.
And ironically, the ostraca have immortalized the names of many people who were ostracized because we've got them. They last.
Yeah, they've survived. That's such a good point.
Because I love drawing a parallel with the modern world, there's a TikTok trend at the moment to draw or write out your sort of like anxieties or trauma on plates and then smash them in places. So it's obviously a behaviour that people are still engaging
I think the cathartic power of plate smashing really unites us across time.
And smashing of statues from the Greek or Roman period is interesting because I think they believed that the spirit of the god actually could live in them. And if you smash it, you release it and take away the power.
Mm.
And they think, some people think that's one reason so many statues have come down to us smashed or with decapitated or whatever. And that's why we find many heads, you know, of emperors and stuff tossed in the river. It's to take away their power.
Yeah. But on that note, there's something I thought of earlier in terms of kind of attributing power to names. And in the Roman world, I think it was more like locations, especially when it came to the gods. So they believed that the gods, if they had a temple, they could like live not only in the statues, but also inside that particular temple, or they could be physically in that temple at any given point in time. However, if they had lots of temples, like Apollo, who's very popular, had lots of temples all over the ancient world, how would your prayer reach him if he just didn't happen to be in the temple you were praying at that particular moment? So they were worried that the prayer wouldn't get through. And so there was this kind of stock phrase that they would use where it was like, dear Apollo of this particular temple, but also wherever you may be and also your other temples, just in case.
That's amazing. That's like Father Christmas. How's he going to get to us?
Yeah.
I like that covering of all bases, though, because I definitely remember as a child thinking, right, God, if you're listening, and also any other deities that may be listening.
Just that's a very powerful instinct, especially in the Greco-Roman world, is, you know, do not forget any god, because if you forget Eris, she's going to come, and the goddess of strife will come and ruin your wedding and cause years of trouble.
I was just going to link back to the god thing. You do also get, in Greek, you get a lot of names which are named after gods. Like we call them theophoric names, so like god carrying. And they're really cool because they're often, so like Theodore is from the Greek name, like you get Theodoros or Theodotos, and that means the dotor or doros is like given by or given to or whatever. You could be called Dionysius, which is sort of from, like my name, Dyson, is from Dionysus, but you just add the little I in, which means it's kind of derived from that name, because to actually carry the name of the god would be bad. So you've got to sort of slightly distance yourself.
I came across a late Roman name. This is after the empire had converted to Christianity, that was Quod Vult Deus, which is whatever God wants. And it reminded me of some kind of modern Arabic names like Abdullah, which means servant of Allah. So there's, you know, other cultures that continue that tradition.
And in Hebrew, of course, almost every name has a form of God in it, you know. Like Yonatan means given by God.
Raphael, Gabriel.
Those names with meanings are so cool.
But all names have meanings, right? This is
But what you were saying, Barney, earlier about like whether or not people will understand those meanings, I think that's the key thing. Like when people, when you introduce yourself, people probably aren't like, oh yes, the son of the prophet, welcome to the pub. But they did, like, in that's what I was kind of getting at with, like, the sort of woman who's called having a fine army, and people are aware of the illogic of that. And you get, like, puns. So in the Bacchae, Pentheus, who's sort of, he's getting into all sorts of trouble, his name is from Penthos, which means sorrow. So people kind of keep making jokes about it, but it's not very funny. They're like, you know, Tiresias says Pentheus is going to bring Penthos to your house. And when Pentheus introduces himself, Dionysus is like, yeah, you're well suited to be sorrowful.
On the concept of nominative determinism and nowhere near the ancient world, whilst researching my husband's family tree, he has got a direct ancestor whose name is Lettuce Looker, which sounds funny because lettuce, but it's actually a derivative of Letitia and was actually quite common at the time. And another one that fortunately wasn't his relative but was on the same census page was called Wet Milk.
Wet Milk.
Wet Milk. And I don't know if they were a dairy family or what they were. But you're right, Meg. There's a difference, isn't there, between names that mean something to us now. So I can meet someone called Charity or Chastity even and go, I know what that means because that's in the language, that's in the parlance that I use day to day. But if I met a Jonathan or a Meg, a Barney, a Xenia, a Caroline, I'd be like, ah, neat name. Don't know what it means.
On nominative determinism, I have a good quote by Plautus, the Roman playwright of the 2nd century BC, I believe, who said, nomen est omen. The name is an omen. So be careful what you name your children.
Oh, again, that kind of almost like apotropaic thing coming through. Amazing.
Exactly, exactly.
Is it solely as a warning, though, Caroline? So if I call my child disobedient little scumbag, will that come to pass? Or what if I call them does really well in maths? Then they'll be good.
I think it's so fascinating because I think we instinctively have feelings about names. For example, if I were to say two English names, Jack or Sebastian, there's obviously a different feel. Which one of those is going to be better at rugby? Well, it's obviously Jack, isn't it? And of course, that's ridiculous, but we have an instinct about those things.
We do. And I just would like to compound that by saying, imagine a person with the name Bertha. And I bet we're all imagining the same type of person.
What about Wet Milk? Who are we imagining for Wet Milk?
I was thinking when I was looking into Egyptian names about interesting ways that names have kind of helped historiography or archaeology or anything like that. So not just the meaning of names, but like how names can be useful to us in the modern day. I guess part of onomastics, right, which is one of my favorite words, does sound like something you'd get kicked out of a classroom for doing, but it is in fact the study of names. Is it a Greek origin, Meg?
Yes, onoma means name, like onomatopoeia.
Nice. Use of that. So yeah, and Egyptian rulers had five titles. And the names that we know them by are often their personal name. So Amenhotep, Tutankhamun, all those sorts of things are personal names. But they also had a Horus name, a golden Horus name, a throne name, and a two ladies name.
It reminds me a bit, Barney, of Daenerys Stormborn of House Targaryen, the first of her name, Queen of the Andals and the First Men, Protector of the Seven Kingdoms, the Mother of Dragons, the Khaleesi, the Grey Glassy, the Unburnt, the Breaker of Chains.
Oh my God.
Show off.
Wow.
That was so impressive. Like, you're going to have to put that in your name on Twitter.
It's really, I feel so flattered that you think that I didn't open up Google and read it directly. But it reminds me a bit of that kind of, like, obviously that's memed on a little bit, I think, to be fair, is the ridiculous string of titles. But actually, that's maybe not so far from the truth.
Yeah, no, five names for a ruler. Yeah, it's not. I mean, I guess Daenerys's names there are sort of, some of them are features, right? Like the Stormborn thing relates to her being born during a storm, whereas others are to do with her heritage. But yeah, no, so Egyptian kings basically had a lot of names. And the name that we know them by is not necessarily the name that they were known by at the time, right? So Amenhotep III, for example, his throne name is Neb-Mart-Re. But as he appears in the Amarna letters, which are these international correspondence documents that I think we've talked about quite a lot in the past, that were sent between the different great kings of the ancient Near East, ancient world, basically, his name is rendered in Akkadian as Ni-Ib-Mu-A-Re'a. So that's the Akkadian rendering of Neb-Mart-Re, and it might help work out how the Egyptians were pronouncing the sounds of their names at the time. Interestingly, Mart in the middle, which hasn't T in it when we pronounce it, only has a mua in the Akkadian rendering. So it gives a clue that maybe they weren't pronouncing the end of that word as we think today.
Like how we anglicise certain names, like we might turn Alexei into Alex, and how we anglicise even country names as well.
Yeah, like reconstructing it from pronunciation. It's like, this is a place name, but I live in Bristol, and that's from like a really old name, Brigstow. And I can't remember what that means. But because Bristol has the terminal L, like the accent, the sort of West Country accent, you put an L on the end of words. So Brigstow becomes Bristol.
You find that in Latin a bit too. Like over time, the V turns into a B. And sometimes they don't write their grammar properly. And then that kind of bad grammar becomes actually embedded, just becomes the new form of grammar. So my mum, whenever she goes to graveyards in the UK, will send me pictures of any Latin inscriptions, and then I have to translate them, which is quite helpful to keep my Latin in practice. But yeah, there was one that she sent me, I think from Cornwall, and I was like, this makes absolutely no sense. All the Latin is completely wrong. It was from about the 6th century AD. But yeah, the kind of way that the words were pronounced and the way they wrote the grammar had simply evolved.
I wonder if that's Romans teaching people in the local vicus to speak proper Latin, and they've gone, right, I'll give it a go. Yeah. And it's like that Monty Python scene where there's the Romans who live in the house, they go home.
Yes.
Yeah, classic.
Exactly. Like heek here, for here lies, just became eek.
Eek. Big eek.
Right, favourite things that we've learned today. Caroline, I'm going over to you. What was your favourite thing that you've learned from today?
Oh my gosh, I think it was all the Egyptian names, all the kind of attachments to a name you could have, including the two ladies and the Horus and the Golden Horus. So I loved all that. Want to know more about that?
Absolutely. In which case, Barney, I'm going to go over to our resident Egyptian expert. What was your favourite thing you learned today?
I think I like Meg's nominative determinism the best. I think it's great. Especially being able to trace that Dionysus link so far back. It's a brilliant example of how much meaning we can find out from our own names. Love it.
It is rather marvellous. And Meg, I shall go over to you with your double nominative determinism name.
Yes, as the son of Dionysus, I think my favourite thing was Caroline's idea of kind of apotropaic names. I think that's so interesting.
Fabulous. Xenia, what was your favourite thing that you've learned today?
So my favourite thing was the joke Greek names, especially for women's names, from Meg. But can I just also say, I also had a least favourite thing, which was the kind of lack of personal identity that women get pretty much across the ancient world, maybe apart from the ancient Near East. It's very annoying.
It is annoying. Do you know what? I was actually going to pick that as my favourite thing, but only because I'm determined to turn nasty things into nice things and go, look how far we've come, ladies. So my favourite thing today is that things might be bad, but at least we can have our own names.
Yay!
I could leave you with a nice example of a female name from the ancient Near East. That, again, yes, yeah, they don't tend to be male derived or male adjacent or anything like that. They do seem to get women do seem to get in their own names, and one that I like, a sort of a birth based name, is Tutsi Dumcut, which means she came out, she is beautiful.
Oh, that's a lovely omen.
That's really nice. And then the next daughter's called Emily and she's like, guys.
I'd also like to quickly say a big thank you at the end of the episode on behalf of all the ancient Egyptians, because by speaking their names on this podcast, we are active participants in ensuring their own eternity. Pat on the back all round, everyone.
Good stuff.
What a great episode. Thank you, Caroline. That was really, really interesting. I've got loads of things to Google now.
Thanks. It was a privilege to join you as ever.